My name's Mike Steinberg, and I want to welcome all of you tonight, and I'm glad to see so many people here. Can you hear me in the back? Sean, can you hear me in the back?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thanks. Before I do the formal introduction, there are people to say thank you to. The sponsors for Patricia Hampel's reading tonight are the MSU Library, the College of Arts and Letters, with a special thanks to Pat McConaughey and Linda Hansen, and for the library, Peter Berg, Ruth Ann Jones, and Bertie Beckwith. The English Department, Pat O'Donnell, the Honors College to Scott Vaughn, thanks. The Writing Center to Laura Julia and Janet Swenson, and the MSU Press, Laura Luptowski, Fred Bohm, Martha Bates. I'll do the formal thing first, and that is read you Patricia Hampel's credits. Patricia Hampel is Regents Professor of English at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, where she has taught creative writing since 1982. Her two memoirs are A Romantic Education from Houghton Mifflin, 1981, reissued with a new afterword by the author, 1992, and will be reissued again in a month or so. And Virgin Time, in Search of the Contemplative Life, also in 1992, and that's the one book that's out there on the book table. Spillville, her imaginative study of Antonin Dvorak's stay in an Iowa farming village, was published by Milkweed Editions with engravings by Stephen Sorman in 1987. She has two books of poetry, Woman Before an Aquarium from the University of Pittsburgh Press in 1978, and Resort and Other Poems from Houghton Mifflin in 1993. She's the editor of Burning Bright, an anthology of sacred poetry from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, published by Ballantine in 1995, and the Houghton Mifflin Anthology of Short Fiction, 1984. Hampel's short fiction, essays, and poetry have appeared in American Poetry Review, The New Yorker, Paris Review, Iowa Review, and Plowshares, among many other journals. Her grants and awards include a MacArthur Fellowship, an Ingram Merrill Fellowship, the Houghton Mifflin Literary Fellowship for a Romantic Education, and grants from the Bush Foundation and National Endowment for the Arts. She's a frequent visitor to writing programs and conferences in the United States and Europe, and is on the permanent faculty of the Prague Summer Sessions. I Could Tell You Stories, a collection of her essays on memory and imagination, will be published in a month or so, and that's what you'll read from tonight. To get a little personal, I want to say a few words of my own. As you can see from that impressive list of credits, Patricia Hampel is one of our most versatile and accomplished authors. She is a writer's writer. By this I mean someone who practicing writers admire and aspiring writers want to emulate. She's been well recognized for her two highly acclaimed memoirs, A Romantic Education and Virgin Time, and for Spillville, which I'll talk about in a minute. On the surface, A Romantic Education is about Hampel's journey to Prague to trace her grandmother's roots, and Virgin Time is about a series of pilgrimages she's made to Italy, France, and California in an effort to understand and examine her own religious impulses. But listen to the author's comments about her own works. In a recent interview, Patricia Hampel says, "The whole issue of memoir is a vexed one, and therefore particularly interesting. In memoir, a person appears to be writing autobiography, my story, the story of my life. What could be more self-absorbed, more egotistical? What could be more interiorized? But my own experience of memoir has been something different. In A Romantic Education, my subject was the political and historical reality of another country. In Virgin Time, it was the reality of a religion, Catholicism. In both instances, the memoir encouraged me not only to go inward, but to go outward to issues that were far larger than me." And in a recent review of Spillville, the reviewer writes, "In 1985, Hampel, together with engraver Stephen Sorman and a few friends, made a pilgrimage to Spillville, a tiny Iowan village founded by Czechs from Bohemia. It is where in 1893 Dvorak spent a summer composing I Studied with the Birds, Flowers, Trees, God, and Myself among his former countrymen. It is also Hampel's landscape, for she was born of Czech ancestors who settled the American Midwest. In a wonderful 102 pages that weave memoir and history, lyricism and meditation, humor and romanticism, we come to understand the surprising dips and curves of this land and how they inspire art, wonderful engravings by Sorman, music and words, past and present, crisscrossing time and space. What draws me particularly to Patricia Hampl's work is her eclecticism, her lyricism, her fierce intelligence, her largesse of spirit, and her ability to use the personal to reach for larger meanings, more universal truths. She combines a poet's language and sensibility with a fiction writer's expansive imagination. In her prose, she always searches for and discovers the right descriptive detail, image, turn of phrase. One of the defining characteristics of the essayist or memoirist is the writer's voice or presence, his or her singularity as a persona, if you will. Whether Patricia Hampl is being confessional or observant, her presence is felt in every line she writes. Her memoirs and essays are lyrical, reflective, meditative, and at the same time full of wisdom, wonder, and plain old common sense. In addition to being one of this culture's finest literary memoirists, Hampl is also someone who is helping to redefine and shape the debate about this sometimes mistakenly maligned genre. One of the things that originally drew me to literary nonfiction was the fact that many of its writers were among its most incisive commentators. In fact, I first came to know Patricia Hampl's work through her essay about memoir entitled Memory and Imagination. It was written, I think, in the mid-80s, and I believe it is still the most thoughtful essay that's been written about this evolving form. In it, she says, among many other things, that true memoir is written in an attempt to find not only a self, but a world. The self-absorption that seems to be the impetus and embarrassment of autobiography turns into, or perhaps always was, a hunger for the world. Actually, it begins as a hunger for a world, one gone or lost, effaced by time, or a more sudden brutality. But in the act of remembering, the personal environment expands, resonates beyond its subject into the endless and tragic recollection that is history. I could say so much more about Patricia Hampl's work, but I've probably talked too long already. I just want to remind you before I turn this over that there will be a reception, an informal Q&A after the reading, and a book signing, and you can get the books out in the lobby and bring them in here. And so it's time for me to turn this over to the writer you came to hear and see. Please help me welcome Patricia Hampl.
Well, I have to, I'm sort of startled. I'm loaded here with a noisemaker. I want to begin with thanks, too. As you can imagine, after an introduction like that, I have a lot of gratitude in my heart to Michael and also to Carol. Where are you? There you are. You were over there before. For bringing me here and treating me with such honor and such attention. It's really thrilling to have you all here, and I know I'm grateful to you as well already for being here, but I know that one of the reasons I can be grateful to you is because Michael went to all the trouble to see to it that you couldn't get away from my face in the newspaper and elsewhere, and so you knew that it might be worthwhile to come. So I'm very grateful. It means a lot to a writer to have this opportunity to see readers face to face and to be able to read to you, that ancient association I think a lot of us have a lot of fondness for. I'm going to read you one piece from I Could Tell You Stories. This is what I call the Army Issue Edition. It's the uncorrected page proof, so it's going to look a lot prettier when it comes out as a book, but this is all I have at the moment. And this is a bunch of short form memoirs, sort of like to the memoir, what the short story is to the novel, in addition to a number of literary essays. So I'm going to read you one, you'll be glad to know, that is not a literary essay, but is, in fact, a bit of a story. I don't think I have to tell you too much about this, except to say that you'll see, any of you who know a romantic education about my Czech connection will see that this is a small story that is a kind of sidebar to that long memoir. The title is What She Couldn't Tell. Everything about Mrs. Baranek the elaborate subterfuge of her hospitality, the dark bunker of her watchful brown eyes, should have told me she harbored a secret. But I was incapable of recognizing the secret of her kind. I was almost 30 when I met her, and I had piled up a number of romantic injuries which preoccupied me. They were my only experience of drama and dislocation. These, I thought, were secrets, shameful romantic stories that could be told, but weren't. Real secrets hang up. Am I doing something wrong? No? Just keep going and just the show must go on, even with these. Okay. Real secrets hang upside down in their bat caves, invisible in the dark, emitting a faint radar of dread. Mrs. Baranek's secret was like that, a signal rather than a story. She was old and foreign and had a serious little black mustache, which made her look prim rather than masculine. And in time, I sensed with disquiet that she needed me. These were signals enough to absorb or deflect. In any case, it was I who came to her with a secret, or at least under a false, though benign, pretense. Mr. Henley, a member of the seniors' poetry group I taught at the Jewish Community Center in St. Paul, one of the many publicly funded jobs I held in the plummy 70s, heard that I was looking for a Czech tutor. I wanted to learn the language of my grandparents, I said. Mrs. Baranek, he cried, this is the person. Later it turned out he didn't know if Mrs. Baranek was prepared to teach a language. His objective, as ever, was to do good. At 90, still a shedder of light. Mrs. Baranek's husband had died earlier in the year, and Mr. Henley wanted someone sympathetic, as he said, to visit his old friend on a regular basis. Someone young, he said, pausing to assess me for a moment, and apparently deciding I still qualified. No one believed I was 30. Like everyone around me, I had attenuated the light of adolescence to the furthest, faintest point before I disappeared past 40 into the tunnel of adulthood. No marriage, no children, no mortgage, no credit card debt, no car, no real job. I wrote poetry in the morning, sitting on my only chair, an aluminum lawn chaise strung with thin plastic strips which left deep impressions on the back of my clothes. When I got up, it looked as if I had been whipped about the back and legs with a rod. My studio apartment had a crumbling wall which I called my Italian villa. It was the life of the imagination. The leavings of the still buoyant great society supported me. I meandered among part-time jobs and community centers and nursing homes, teaching poetry, taping oral histories, gazing into the milky eyes of the elderly who were touchingly glad of the company. We had a lot in common. I was living like a pensioner myself. As far as Mr. Henley knew, Mrs. Baranek had no one else in the world, certainly no one in America. She had a heart condition and recently had been outfitted with a pacemaker. Maybe it was the pacemaker and not the dead husband which made her a special ward of his concern. Anyway, she should be visited. And the driver's license people had made Mr. Henley give up his car, which badly cramped his style. You go, he said, with the decisiveness that characterized his habit of tending his dwindling band of fellow emigres. It was 1976. Most of those left in his circle were women, widows, or, like the remaining one of his three sisters with whom he had always lived, spinsters. These people had landed in St. Paul sometime before or after the Second World War, heaved up on the Midwest's flat bosom by one version or another of the European nightmare. Now they were growing old, very old, in a country most of them had lived in longer than the Germany or Austria, Poland or Czechoslovakia of their birth. In Europe, they would never have met, would have seen themselves as distinct, even inimical, Jews, Gentiles, Poles, Germans, Czechs. But in St. Paul, they had been thrown together in an unlikely Middle Western Mitteleuropa. They recognized each other, were magnetized by each other. They were from, or simply were, the old world, the singular place that claimed them and exiled them all at once, but from which, even here in the American heartland, they could never truly emigrate. They were elaborately courteous to each other and met not for cards and bunco like the working class immigrants I knew from my grandmother's circle, but to listen to the Saturday Texaco opera broadcasts. They cooked heavy, sedative meals and baked extravagant coffee cakes, They served sweet wine in thimble glasses and toasted graciously, encouraging each other to have some more. Go ahead, enjoy yourself. Mr. Henley made all the arrangements for our first meeting. She's a good cook, he said reverently. I should expect cake. The hour specified, 1 p.m, might even indicate something more substantial. He felt it impolite to inquire, but he thought I should prepare myself for lunch. The event was understood to be an introductory affair. The notebook apparently was a prop, but a necessary one, meant to affirm my seriousness about the language of my ancestors, or maybe to belie any possible suspicion that I was Mr. Henley's minion sent on a condolence call. For that was his secret, kindness. Mrs. Baranek lived in a high-rise on the frontage road of Interstate 94, the building rising whitely up at the side of the freeway connecting St. Paul and Minneapolis, was not so different from the socialist-realist Panalaki buildings that were forming the grim suburban wall around Prague at the same time. Mrs. Baranek's building was a little better made, and it was a solo monolith, not one in a yawning expanse of such structures, but as I entered it the first time, I registered the place as brutal. The tenants were not being housed, but detained. The great pale building stands there still, but in 1976 it was more exotic in its flattened affect than it appears today. Now it is oddly unremarkable. But in 1976, the great sprawl of suburban high-rises, the word condo, the sheer height and forbidding Cold War architecture of Mrs. Baranek's building, they were all new to us. These high-rise warehouses, so unlike the red brick fourplexes where maiden aunts had been living amidst the scent of stewed cabbage and lavender sachet since the 30s, gave off a sinister anonymity in St. Paul's intensely related neighborhoods. Another such looming building was being built downtown, overlooking the river. It was intended for the well-to-do. From the outside, it looked a lot like Mrs. Baranek's subsidized high-rise. It seemed strange not to be able to tell a poor person's house from a rich person's. But here, on the side of the new freeway that only a few years before had scooped out the generations-old black neighborhood of Rondo and tossed it away to create the deep chute of the superhighway, Arabella Baranek, formerly a fashionable Prague Six, now made her home with African Americans displaced by the freeway and with Southeast Asians just arriving from the latest war, with welfare mothers and handicapped people on SSI. A woman in a beige dress who always introduced herself as a nun, I'm Sister Eileen, had an office on the first floor and explained that she was liaison for the residents, though it was never clear with whom or what she made liaison. She lived in the building rent-free. She had fastened on Mrs. Baranek as an island of educated refinement in her boombox and graffiti mission. She knows five languages, don't you? She said to Mrs. Baranek, addressing the tenant of Unit 1803 with the peculiar awe mixed with envy that is accorded millionaires. Our first lesson went well. There was strudel. A buttery wave rolled onto the brown sugar beach of a dough so thin it was impossible to imagine how Mrs. Baranek had cajoled it to hold its oceanic bounty of apple and raisin and cinnamon. Next to the slice of strudel on the porcelain plate, she shook from a serving spoon a heavy, cumulus pile of schlehatsko. It was the first word she taught me, whipped cream. I was returned to the entrancing despotism of my girlhood when my dead grandmother's powers with yeast dough had ruled. We were an eating family, vassals to her lordly ways with chicken and pot roast, her flick-of-the-wrist noodles, and her break-your-heart pie crusts. I knew great pastry when I saw it. In Mrs. Baranek's high-rise, I was not simply at home. I was in the cold clutches again of an artist. She had my grandmother's same satisfied silence as she watched me eat. Eating, in fact, proved to be my main accomplishment as her student. When I arrived at the high-rise for my weekly lesson, it was necessary first to dial the security phone, another exotic device for us in 1976, which was in the corner of the vestibule. Then Mrs. Baranek, 18 floors above in her one bedroom, would enter a code on her wall phone, which caused the big metal and glass door near me to emit a high, strangled sound of the kind that causes dogs to cringe. The door would then allow itself to be opened. The problem was, if I stayed on the security phone as Mrs. Baranek instructed, by the time I made the hop to the door, the rasp had abruptly stopped and the door perversely refused to open. Meanwhile, other people were letting themselves in and out making their way to the bank of elevators I could see beyond. But it was understood, signs with severe admonitions were posted on the wall, that no one without a key or an escort was allowed into the building. Beautiful young black girls flounced past with their keys, dismissing me with neutral disdain as they slammed the door in my face. Sister Eileen, trolling the corridors, often came to my rescue. "I think it's wonderful you're studying your grandparents' language," she said approvingly, "looking for your roots." When I stepped out of the elevator on the 18th floor, Mrs. Baranek was always waiting for me. She even had my grandmother's body, small, round, the stout build of a generalissimo, and she conducted me back to her apartment as if there were no time to spare before maneuvers began. I was directed to the table in the dining room, a corner of the living room near the kitchen. There was a view of Montgomery Ward's parking lot and a car dealership beyond. The tabletop, made of formica, was covered with a lace cloth. A low cut glass bowl held a bundle of plastic ivy leaves. The sugar bowl was large and the table was always set. A solitary cup and saucer sat at Mrs. Baranek's place at the head of the table. My place, facing the sideboard below the window, held the works: dinner plate, soup bowl, salad plate, cup, saucer, glass, silver. First, she always said, "We eat." Then she disappeared into the kitchen. She had herded a collection of framed photographs onto the sideboard. Most of them were recent, pictures she identified for me as Bonnie, her husband's last nurse, and Bonnie's large family. Snapshots of her husband looking thin and, I thought, terribly weak. He had died, Mrs. Baranek told me, of congestive heart failure and emphysema. She could see him fading right before her eyes. "But we were happy," she said proudly, "right to the end, very happy." She picked up a picture frame and dusted the glass with a corner of her apron, unconsciously stroking his face. The face in the photograph looked severe, even sour, but maybe I thought that was the illness. There were a few older pictures, including a wedding portrait from the 20s. The satin train of Mrs. Baranek's dress, carrying forward the Schlehatsko motif, was swirled in a creamy puddle at the feet of the smug-looking bridal couple. A large black and white photograph dominated the group, propped in a possibly real silver frame. It was clearly from a later period, the women wearing the short-skirted, square-shouldered suits of the 40s. This small group, apparently on vacation, but dressed to the nines, stood on a terrace before a hotel, mountains, the Tatras, I later learned, spiking grandly behind them. I would give a lot to have that picture before me now. For one thing, though I can clearly see Mr. Baranek standing straight, his black hair slicked back, I cannot remember if he was wearing his uniform as an officer in the Czechoslovak army or was dressed in a civilian suit. This would be a valuable distinction. The Sam Brown leather belt running diagonally across his chest one day is perversely supplanted the next time I bring the picture to mind by a smoky three-piece suit with high-buttoned waistcoat. I can see the dull brass on the leather belt, but also the black poker chip buttons that punctuate the tweedy waistcoat. Tricks of memory. But the dark hat Mrs. Baranek wore, that snaps back in disturbing focus, real, not remembered. It is cocked sharply over her left eyebrow, casting a bold eye in shadow. When was it, I now wonder, that I became suspicious of the hat? It was an unsettling hat. I regarded with vague disquiet its aggressive angle, shadowing Mrs. Baranek's smiling face. But I didn't pursue the thought. I kept spooning in the Schlehatsko, licking buttery crumbs off my fingers while I copied irregular verbs into my notebook week after week. Mr. Henley's plan was working. I was spending a lot of time with Mrs. Baranek. I borrowed my mother's car and drove her to the Henleys for lunch. I took her to the bank. I delivered her to the German Cultural Club for the fall sauerkraut dinner. She came home with me for Thanksgiving. I took her to Mass now and again. I got in the habit of taking her grocery shopping. She was a wily shopper, her purse bulging with carefully scissored newspaper coupons, which she paid out of the checkout counter like a stack of chips at a casino. She was gleeful about her strategic buying, by turns petulant over the price of peaches, and then contemptuous of what the supermarket thought she would pay for a cut-up chicken. Ha! She'd cut up her own chicken. I drove her all over town, stalking deals, running up mileage on my mother's car. In the spring, we went to the cemetery where her husband was buried. It was the Catholic cemetery. My grandmother and grandfather were buried there too, under a pine tree in an old shady section I had always found pleasant. Mrs. Baranek had purchased an imposing marker for her husband in the bright, treeless area, full of recent monuments where in summer patches of the grass burned brown. She had engraved on the monument not only Mr. Baranek's name and dates, but her own name and birth date, followed by an eloquent hyphen waiting in the stone like a held breath. She always wept a bit at the cemetery. Once she clutched my arm as we approached the big gray granite stone and asked desperately, "It isn't possible, it isn't, is it, that after everything we will never meet again? We must meet again, don't you think we must?" The mustache quivered fiercely. "Of course," I answered immediately. She looked at me with misgiving. "We must meet again," she replied furiously, as if I had contradicted her. She stood in the unforgiving sun, not a tree to shade the place, frantic with disbelief at his disappearance. She was waiting impatiently in the echoing terminal of her grief until, as she knew he soon must, he came to retrieve her. She doled out her story a little at a time. She had been an opera singer. This and her position in Prague's haute bourgeoisie explained all the languages. She worked for the Americans in Germany after the war, translating from German and Czech, though her French and Italian were just as good. She said it was the best job she ever had. When she and her husband landed finally in St. Paul, middle-aged and penniless, in the early 1950s, they both found jobs at the Tony factory, home of the famous, to us, Tonette Home Permanent. At first, she worked on the line. Eventually, she moved to an office job. It was never clear to me what her husband did there or why they ended up in St. Paul, having entered the country in New Orleans. They hung on to their Tonette jobs for dear life. They spoke of the Tony Company patriotically, as if by working for the cosmetics industry, she and her husband had done national service, serving their adopted country in its time of need. Apparently, she had not worked in Prague. She was not even quite a professional singer, it seems, though she had trained for the opera. Saint-Saëns, she said, wanted her to be the first Melisande in Pelléas et Mélisande. Saint-Saëns? I was all agog. She offered no more. She had turned down Saint-Saëns in order to marry Mr. Baranek. I was given to understand that theirs had been a great love, that between Saint-Saëns and Mr. Baranek, there had been no contest. And how did she spend her days after her marriage during the 15 years of the First Republic before Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia? She paused, shaking her head in mild wonder at this other life which was improbable now even to her. "I don't know," she said after a moment. "I believe I planned what we would have for dinner." An absurd life, lazy and ordered and harmless. There was a small staff, a cook and a maid. The flat was large, weighted with Biedermeier. She practiced her singing, she read novels. She met her friends for coffee in the afternoon. In the evening, there was the theater or an opera. Prague then was like Montreal, a dual culture city, and they went to plays at the German and the Czech theaters. It was a dreamy existence, playing house, gossiping, warbling a bit in the music room, keeping up her languages. No children. "It was not possible for us," she said, opening and shutting the subject. "People without children have the closest marriages," she added. "I was never lonely." Until now, of course. Sometimes she brought out her picture albums and we looked them over together. Her husband, again, with the smug, turning sour face in his army uniform, in a buffed studio photograph from the early 30s, pages of snapshots from Tony Company annual picnics, others from German cultural club gatherings. She was Czech, not German. But in St. Paul, it seemed not to matter. She liked to use her German. It was the language she and Mr. Henley and his sister used when I wasn't around. Though she was Catholic, she sometimes went with them to Jewish community center affairs. One day, she shyly, proudly, presented a yellowed feature piece dating from the early 50s from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, which was pasted into an album. Mrs. Baranek, dark-haired, robust, not yet an old lady, beamed from a desk at the Tony Company. A thin but not yet gaunt Mr. Baranek stood behind her, looking mildly, if a bit uncomfortably, into the camera. The article was bannered with a rich anti-communist scream of a headline which I no longer remember. The Baraneks told of escaping from the Reds. They could not live in such a prison as their country had become, the article said, and had risked everything to get to freedom, that is, to Minnesota, to us. Mrs. Baranek's languages were noted as if they comprised a fabulous foreign bank account she had somehow managed to sneak across the border when she had fled in the night, dogs snapping at her heels. The courage and resourcefulness of their passion for freedom, the reporter wrote, had brought them at last to our midst. They acknowledged the terrible life behind the Iron Curtain and their vast relief in arriving in a free land, their hope of making new lives in service to the Tony Company. They wanted people to know how thankful they were. They wanted to be useful, productive citizens in their new country, they said, ending the piece on an oddly socialist sentiment. In another album, Mrs. Baranek had mounted a large, more recent picture that looked like the publicity glossy of an actress, which is exactly what it was. My cousin's daughter, she said, she's an actress in Prague, when she can get work. The face was Liv Ullmann, lovely, lyrical, strong. You can meet her when you go back to Prague. I had been to Prague the year before, and I was crazy to return. This was the point of studying Czech. I said and believed that my passion for the city had to do with my grandparents, my roots, as Sister Eileen said so approvingly. But it was the city's grainy, noirish quality which had captivated me. It was the opposite of family feeling that propelled me there. I was after a dark otherness. Prague entered me the way bad weather invades a landscape, haunting and enshrining a place more powerfully than a sunny day ever can. I was after that bad weather, the endless drizzle of history, though I didn't understand that I had touched the broken heart of the century in the city's crumbling Baroque buildings and grimy coal dust air. I told Mrs. Baranek that Prague was beautiful. Wasn't that why people went to Europe, for the beauty? Except in the 70s, nobody much went to Prague. It was the first European city I saw, and I experienced it in its isolation and humiliation. I traveled like a sleepwalker, drawn out of sun and snow, Minnesota, going alone, I knew not why, into the night strangeness of the gray and smudged gold Bohemian capital. After Prague, I took a train to Paris and was secretly ashamed that the city of lights meant nothing, nothing. I couldn't see it. I stood before the Arc de Triomphe and said in my bored heart, so? Give me back the ruined gold of Praha. It's easier now, after the Cold War, to understand what I sought there, what secrets and fascinations that part of the world held in its closed fist for the West. The land of Mozart and the concentration camps, beer and jackboots, all that was behind the Iron Curtain, as we said for decades, relying on that most eloquent of political metaphors to hide it all and say it all. The east wing of the great European mansion was closed off, we really thought, forever. The furniture shrouded in dusty muslin, all the relatives lost or scattered. For Mrs. Baranek, it was forever. Oh, no, she said, horrified. I would never go back. The freedom lover, who had fled with only a rucksack on her back, shuddered at the thought of return. Mr. Henley, I reminded her, had gone back. The Lutheran minister of Ulm, his hometown, had invited him and his remaining sister back to Germany. At first, Mr. Henley had refused. How could he go back? But after a while, he decided, yes, it was time. There must be forgiveness, he told me. He said this, there must be forgiveness, not as a sentiment or as an earnest wish, but as a fact, pronouncing it like the bottom line accountant he had been in his American cousin's furniture store since he arrived from Europe. The strict economy of history required pardon, not because there was no guilt to be assigned, or no abiding outrage in the human heart, but because the force of time pushed green shoots out of the bloodied earth, and Mr. Henley bowed his gaunt face respectfully to the new growth. The future, uncaring though it was, had its rights. This was his attitude, profoundly unsentimental, yet not cynical. He refused rage, it seemed, because it turned too surely into piety. He did not like the word the Holocaust. He did not approve of the package, the tidiness, the word made of chaos, bundling up so much in its furious sound. Yet clearly, he remembered everything that was lost to him. He had the lined, ascetic face of a scholar who pondered alone. He and his sister had returned to Ulm the previous year. They were treated like heroes, or perhaps like the dead risen again to life. So many had not come back. But here they were, the Henleys, owners, once upon a time, of the city's best dry goods store, back, alive. Well, two of them, anyway. He told the story of the trip without delight or triumph, without bitterness. He did not dwell on psychological closure or any such fluff. It seemed that he had gone finally from that most natural, the most neutral, but also most galvanizing of human instincts. He was curious. "Well, the Henleys are Jewish," Mrs. Baranek said. "They can go back." The soured look, the one in her husband's formal portraits from before the war, touched her face, making the little black mustache seem, for once, sinister. "Everyone feels sorry for the Jews." Like the photograph of the Tatra Mountains, where the unsettling dark hat angled aggressively over her bold eye, yes, I realized it was a bold eye, even saucy, this remark grazed me. "Everyone feels sorry for the Jews." I thrust the remark away, fended it off like an unwanted intimacy. It sent the same signal the hat sent. It winked a terrible wink. It beckoned. "If only we had fought, we could have beat the Germans." This was her Czech army officer husband's belief, a faith she repeated as fact. If, in 1938, the Czechs had gone to war against the German annexation of their border territory instead of collapsing into occupation, they would have beat the Germans. Without the help of England and France? I couldn't help asking this question. "Without their help," the black mustache pursed decisively. The generalissimo of the kitchen spoke from the high command of her army officer husband, her five European languages flying their flags. Americans did not understand these things. That took care of the Second World War. There was no more to it. No newspaper clippings in the album, no stories she felt compelled to tell. The war to her was the held breath of the Czech nation, as if the whole occupation had been a blank, an insult without incident. And then the war was over. Well, that was the worst. After the war. The images pulsed across the lace-covered table where I sat behind my notebook and my hazelnut torte. People, neighbors, jumped on the faces of Germans thrown into the streets, jumped with boots, a head soaking in rain and blood and gasoline, just lying there in the gutter outside her apartment building. No body, just a smashed face. People spitting. Ordinary people went into German homes. They killed them in their beds, threw them out their windows, stole things, as if they were dogs, oh, much worse than the way a dog is treated. Yes, she agreed. People were angry after the Nazi occupation. But these were human beings too, she said. She fastened me with a pleading look, so strange I remember it more absolutely than her voice. These were human beings too. I nodded, I clucked along, I agreed, my mouth full of hazelnut ganache, that the Germans too were human beings. The smashed head in the street, ground down by a Czech boot, was reason enough to shudder. But I knew then, years before I allowed myself to turn back to that scene and memory, not the memory of her bloodied Prague street, but the scene of the two of us meeting in the sugar haze of our lesson over her lace-covered formica table, that this post-war horror was not what her eyes were pleading with me to understand. How strange is the communication of a secret when it cannot speak, when the eyes must send their inchoate signal, asking for what? For forgiveness, absolution. But maybe these words are too crudely decorous for what she sought. She wanted out. She was locked up with something, in something. An oil and water mixture of shame and fury swam in her eyes, seeking an understanding she could not hope to find. She did not deserve this, her locked on me eyes were saying. She had never looked at me like this. Nobody ever has. I felt searched. She wished me to acquiesce to some statement she could not utter, to read her invisible ink. Was it a confession she had in mind? She was trying to pry something out of a reticence so profound it had become a pledge. A pledge to whom? During the war, my husband, she said, looking down for an instant. I knew instinctively she was going to tell me something she had never told anyone, that we were poised together over an abyss where she had stood before only with her husband until this earnest Czech language student came to sit at her table, filling up on refined sugar, a nice American girl with no axe to grind, who had seen nothing but the gloomy Iron Curtain surface of her city and called it beauty. Tell her. A canny foreknowledge flooded me. I snapped alert as a pointer in a cornfield of pheasant. This was what all the trips to the grocery store had been about. the chauffeuring and the cemetery visits, even the weekly check lessons, and my gushing flattery about her baking, though I hadn't realized it. I was not kind, as Mr. Henley was kind, simply and as a matter of character. I had been waiting for this from the first lesson, the spill the beans moment that had been winking at me from under the shadow of her dark wartime hat from the first day. Yes, I said, gently prodding, beckoning her to risk it, to trust me over here across the table in earnest, naive America. Yes, Mrs. Baranek? And in speaking, broke the spell forever. She told me nothing. No, I cannot. Never mind, she said, pulling away. The best she could give me was to acknowledge that she was holding something back, that I was right in presuming that she had almost. She removed her heavy glasses and covered her eyes for a long moment. There may have been tears, but I think it was a drier, more hopeless moment. She kept her crumpled face in her hands. I held my breath behind the hazelnut torte, trying desperately to figure out how to coax her back to the edge of utterance, where we had been standing together only a moment before, where she might still tumble, allowing her terrible truth to fall into my waiting arms. On a raw March night, almost a year later, Sister Eileen called around 10 o'clock. She had a key to the apartment, she said, but she was afraid to go in by herself. She wanted me to come, quickly. For once, when I arrived at the high-rise, I didn't need to be buzzed in. Sister Eileen was waiting at the big glass and metal door. We went up together in the elevator. I have a key, she said again. I have a master key to all the apartments. Most people aren't aware of that. She seemed more nervous than a nun should be, I thought, in the face of ... We could hear the television when we got to Mrs. Baranek's door. This could be a good sign or a bad sign. Sister Eileen knocked, timidly. Nothing. I stepped forward and beat loudly on the hollow chloro door. You better open it, I said finally. It seemed I was in charge, that Sister Eileen wanted me to take command. And there she was, slumped heavily before the television on the lumpy tweed couch in the little living room, the sports news blasting. Her eyes were closed, thank God. Her legs were splayed slightly apart like an exhausted seagull figure waiting at a bus stop after a night shift, the head bent down, but not, we both knew instantly, sleeping. I turned the television off, then wished I hadn't. The noise had a reassuring buoyancy to it, a satisfying surface. Sister Eileen made for the door. She was going to call an ambulance from her own apartment. You wait here, she said, suddenly taking away the command I thought she'd given me. I almost turned the television back on. I wasn't afraid, being alone with her, not Mrs. Baranek anymore, suddenly the body. But the silence felt indecent. It was all too casual, as if death were a brief item tacked on at the end of a broadcast on a slow news day. It seemed wrong to look at her, and I couldn't bring myself to touch her. I found a clean pastel sheet in the bedroom dresser and draped it over her from head to foot, and then felt foolish. What was wrong with just letting her be there, sitting? But once I had covered her, I couldn't bring myself to undrape her. It wasn't even a real gesture, just something I picked up from the movies, pulling the sheet over the face of the dead heroine. As I shook the sheet to cover her, an absurd response, my only authentic one, floated over my mind. What happened to all the languages? As if she had not died but had been robbed, as if someone should be apprehended and held accountable for this theft. I couldn't get the thought out of my mind that the languages had been abducted. It was her Czech and German I mourned for, her operatic Italian and the French she had chosen not to sing for Saint-Saëns. The wealth she had managed to smuggle out of her destroyed Europe, stored here where no one would think of looking for it, in the high rise on the side of a Midwestern freeway, marooned in English with Sister Eileen and me. I looked at the sheeted figure with a kind of awe, but I was not sad, and I was sorry about that. I had not liked her, I realized, and I knew it was too bad it was me she got at the end, not a good person like Nurse Bonnie, who had seen her husband to his end, but me, who stood above her with my cold heart and my suspicions, covering her up like a shameful thing, waiting for someone to take her away. I went back to Prague later that year. I could now read the difference between the words on the men's room and the women's toilets. This roughly was the extent of my check after my months of lessons. It was 1977, still in the deep, dark days in Prague. I looked up the actress cousin whose movie star glossy I had seen in Mrs. Baranek's album. We met outside in Old Town Square, below the black Art Nouveau monument of Jan Hus, the great Czech martyr for the truth, erected during the early optimistic years of the First Republic. The sun was shining, I remember, and the actress, her name refuses to come back, was a little older than I had expected and not glamorous. She lived with her parents in an apartment she also shared with her ex-husband and the ex-husband's current girlfriend. A check arrangement, real estate deciding everything. She told me she had been in a movie with Albert Finney, a speaking part in an Anglo-Czech co-production in the hopeful time before 1968. Now she rarely got calls except for a little radio work. She stayed at home and read novels. She was pale, still beautiful, but drab somehow, as if she no longer counted herself in. She had only known Mrs. Baranek and her husband when she was very small. She hardly had a real memory of either of them. I asked when they had left the country. After the war, she said. She hesitated a moment. You mean 1948, I asked. It was the year of the communist coup in Prague. She looked at me and decided. 1945, she said. Dates are eloquent. We both knew that leaving in 1945 was incriminating. A good Czech stayed after the liberation in 45, and a good Czech might leave in 48, the year of the communist coup. But a good Czech, a blameless Czech, did not run for her life in 1945 after the liberation. I told her I had suspected something. Yes, she said, but she too was in the dark, did not know exactly what it was, and I sensed she really did not know. She used the word collaborator. Mr. Baranek had done what? Something. He had been arrested right after the war. Somehow they had bribed their way out in the very early days and indeed had fled in secret over the border into Germany, dogs snapping at their heels. As Mrs. Baranek said, she had worked for the Americans until they managed to get to America, but they were not anti-communists. They had not fled from the Reds. The story in the Pioneer Press from the 50s, the two of them at their Tony Company jobs, dealing out their escape story to St. Paul readers, shivering a delicious Cold War shiver. It was all a fiction, a great woolly tale they pulled over their own heads as well as ours. Mrs. Baranek, I told the actress, had started to tell me something once, but had stopped, had thought better of trusting me. I described the vacation picture in the Tatras, the mid-war good times, the too fashionable hat. She was having the time of her life, I said. The actress nodded. They were in some kind of trouble, she said. It was something Mr. Baranek had done during the war. It was a long time ago. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Then she asked me about American movies, and the conversation took another turn, away from the war and whatever secret I would never know, and into the unlived life that was her own secret, her lovely eyes wistful and wry, knowing she would never again play opposite Albert Finney. He used to call me Cupcake, she said. We joked around. She paused. We were both leaning against the base of the Jan Hus statue. It was a dream once, she said finally. It wasn't meant to be. Sister Eileen told me not to expect any money. Money? Why would I expect any money? Sister Eileen eyed me closely. Bonnie gets all the money, she said. Nobody else gets anything. It was clear she was hurt. I thought of fabulous sums, the Tony Company heiress living in subsidized housing, her bank account swelling in secret, all of it left to a kind nurse. A morality tale. Be nice. It pays. It turned out there was $20,000, and it did all go to Bonnie. But Sister Eileen was wrong. There was something for me. Bonnie called after I got back from Prague and said Mrs. Baranek had wanted me to have her Prague album. The photographs of Plíšek, somber cityscapes of empty streets and drear river embankments, a city of sleepers, not dreamers, a landscape of absence rather than remembrance, a big headachy book of strangely mute photographs withholding even as they presented the images of the beloved city, the bad weather Prague I was after. Time, we like to say, cures all. But maybe the old saying doesn't mean time heals. Time cures a secret in its brine, keeping it and finally paradoxically destroying it. Nothing is left in that salt solution but the pain or rage, the biting shame that lodged it there. Even they are diluted or denied. Sufficient time must pass, we are told, after a great or defining experience in order to write history, personal or otherwise. Passions must cool, the necessary distance must be achieved. But what really is left to tell from the position of this exemplary coolness? Occasionally, an undissolved sliver floats up from the corrosive murk to pierce and poison the heart. But nothing is left of the thing itself, The secret has completed its vocation of extinction. It's gone, cured, lost in its corrosive element. If you write about me one day, Mrs. Baranek had said, cannily prophetic, don't use my real name. We were sitting together at the lace-covered formica table, drinking sugared coffee, avoiding the Czech lesson as we often did. She was serious. I teased her, but the little black mustache pursed and quivered. She was adamant, made me promise. What shall I call you then? I asked. Baranek, she said brightly, as if she had her pseudonym at the ready all along, just waiting. That was my husband's idea. That's what you should call me, Mrs. Baranek, she added coyly. It means little lamb. She smiled a deep and private smile, luxuriating in her faithful silence as she gazed past the window, past Ward's and the car dealership, to a better time in the abiding radiance of her own innocence. Thank you.
Or you can stay in your seat and ask.
I have a question.
Do you want to stand so people can hear you?
I'm wondering if you think there could possibly be imagination without you.
Can there be imagination without memory? Do you want to tell me where that question is coming from a little bit more? Yes or no.
It's always linked as a phrase, imagination and memory. And obviously your story rides very quickly on memory. And you've thought about it, imagination and memory, quite a bit in writing your autobiographical writing. I'm just wondering if it ever occurred to you what might happen if you had only short-term memory.
I think about it all the time because I not only myself am sometimes struck with how little I can remember, but because of my mother, who's had a stroke and who has lost certain faculties of mind, but not all. So those are conditions that have to do with debility and you know, changing of life. And the question, as I understood it initially, had to do with creative life and how and what you do with, you know, the imagination. I think fiction writers, you know, have a fiction, which is that they make it all up. And memoirists have a fiction, which is that they don't make anything up. And I think both of them are full of hooey, because I think both of them, that membrane is very permeable, that it isn't a line, that it is, in fact, there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between those two. But the other question, I think, having to do with, I assume you're asking about, you know, people who have some kind of mental or neural problem, you know, that we're all amazed. And I would say, who's that guy who writes those wonderful books? The man who mistook Oliver Sacks. I mean, he's the person to ask those questions of, I think.
Well, I was just trying to think of a situation that might take your memory away. And could you still imagine having imagination?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it depends. You know, the real question is what do we define as memory in this case? You know, do we define memory as that thing that is able to carry whole narrative episodes, or does the fact that I remember that this is a table? I mean, there are people who can't remember that that's a table because of certain mental problems. That's the whole thing with the man who mistook his wife for a hat. I mean, those are different kinds of issues altogether. And what we come away from, what Oliver Sacks comes away from, is not, oh, these poor souls, but my God, what an incredible thing the mind is. There's an incredible book by a Russian, I think in the 30s, maybe even the 20s, psychologist named Luria called them, now I'm not going to be able to say this, the mind of the mnemonist, the memory, you know, mnemonist, and it's a story of a guy who couldn't forget anything. You know, we think we have problems because we can't remember stuff. This guy was in deep trouble because he couldn't forget anything. And it's a fascinating study. But, you know, specialized. Anybody else want to ask or say anything? You don't have to ask. You can certainly have your own manifesto if you want to. I've had my say. My MO, sort of. Do I write every day? No. I mean, I write something every day. Do I write something that can be published every day, or do I work on something that can be published every day? No. Partly because I have this kind of troublesome thing called a life, you know, and I have things that impinge. I have elderly parents, or I had elderly parents. Unfortunately, I only have an elderly parent at the moment. My father died a few months ago, and so I have to take care of that. I have a job. I have this. I have that. I have other people whose work, they want me to write a blurb. They want me to tell, you know, and I do it, you know, and maybe I shouldn't do it, but I do do it. And then I stay up late and do my writing. And I mean, I get it done somehow or other, but I don't have a nice, tidy, I get up at 6, I have my tea. By 7, I'm at my desk. Nobody interrupts me until, you know, I just don't live that way. It certainly wasn't hard to take. I would never want to say that, but it put me in a different position at times. It meant that people wanted me to do things, you know, and I was asked to do things, and I, you know, people took me more seriously, which was a problem in a way. I mean, there was more mail coming in, more requests coming in. And, you know, again, is this a problem? Not really, but how much can you do? You're used to saying yes to everything. And all of a sudden, you're still saying yes to everything, but there's 65 times more stuff there than there used to be. So it's, you know, do you know anybody in America who doesn't feel that they're doing too much and they don't have any time? Well, hey, sign me up. I'm just in the same boat. And then I do sometimes just, I go away. I do that kind of classic thing. You know, I go off someplace and I really do hole up for a while. But I also get myself in a position where I have a lot of assignments. And I just meet my deadlines, and I don't ever not meet my deadlines. They get done. So, yeah.
You have most admired memoirs.
I have many that I love, so it's a little difficult to say most admired. You know, I teach a course on the reading of memoir at the University of Minnesota, and I'm teaching it right now, and I begin the course with Speak Memory by Vladimir Nabokov, who is sort of a hard sell to younger students sometimes because his style is Mandarin, lots of long sentences, and you know they just want to say, spit it out. I mean, that's not their style. But he's a favorite of mine, certainly, and I like to try to make him a favorite of others. I don't like Michael Ondaatje's novel, The English Patient. I know, stone me, and I didn't like the movie either. But I love his memoir, Running in the Family. I think it's an absolutely beautiful memoir. I love... Well, see, now when I go home being the hotel, I mean, when I go back there, I'll think, why didn't I say X? Why didn't I say Y? Bob and I were talking today about the French Lessons by Alice Kaplan. It's a book I like very much. I love Colette's little sketches. Alfred Kazin, thank you. I was talking big time about him this afternoon. Alfred Kazin, I love. One more, perhaps? Or maybe way back there.
I just thinking about the dimensions of memory and the dimensions of your work, how do you consider time as an element?
You guys ask the hardest question. Time. Okay, wait a minute. I can do this. Do you want to... Help me.
Well,
E equals MC squared. It has something to do with that. I know it does. But
if I were to think back to the experiences, memories that I had when I was 7 years old, all of my experiences layered, and part of that layering has to do with time. Mm-hmm. And somehow my memory
Okay, I get it. I get it, what you're after now. I think that one of the things we assume is that memoir, autobiographical writing, has one point of view. Me. Moi. Yeah, that's just one. That's it. But the very thing you're talking about, time, is what gives a kind of depth of field and gives a potential multiplicity to the voice. Because I'm telling the story from here. A here, which is an adult here, it's got a particular kind of here. Maybe I let you know that I've been married 6 times and I'm now, you know, just finally my 6th marriage failed and I happen to have 14 kids. You know stuff about me. And that I'm living in, you know, on the Amazon and I'm hunting butterflies in the Amazon and this is who I am now. So, wow, that's me. But then, for reasons having to do with the nature of this book, I go back and I tell you about my childhood in Key West before it was a big tourist area, and I'm doing all that. We've already posited here 2 characters, 2 potential points of view, really. And what happens is you're on the main road of the now person telling the story, but there are all these detours going to other times. And the time is really almost, you could almost say time constellates a new character. Now we know that it's the same person, but we get to go over there and we think we're constantly having the pleasure, and it's a pleasure born of time, of moving back and forth across that net between now and then, back and forth. And it's the pleasure of that, I think, that makes memoir potentially not be, you know, just stuck in the self. That's one of the reasons. I don't know if that fits, but I hope so, because that's about all I could say. Okay, cookies, right? Okay.